Inside Lacrosse Podcasts, the source of the sport.
Welcome to an emergency edition of the Inside Lacrosse Podcast. I am Terry Foy in Ocean City, Maryland, joined by Quinn Kestnick, who I believe, Quinn, are you in Saratoga, New York?
I am. I'm in Saratoga, New York. It's early in the morning. I'm actually at the workouts right now. It's a beautiful Saturday morning. Temperature's going to be high of 75, partly cloudy. And I'm watching the horses gallop here in the morning while drinking some coffee.
So you're satisfying one passion outside of the sport of lacrosse. It is the first Saturday of Premier League football in England. I'm watching my favorite team, who has already scored twice and conceded one goal. And yet, we are talking about our most foremost passion. The game of college lacrosse changed dramatically on Friday when the NCAA Rules Committee instituted a standardized possession clock. It will be 60 seconds when teams cross the midline. That follows a 20-second clearing clock. They also brought back the dive and shrunk the substitution box from 20 yards down to 10, so 5 yards on either side of the midline. There were some additional changes, including a pregame emphasis on sportsmanship. You can find all of these rule changes on InsideLacrosse.com, and we will be joined later by other guests to talk about the TikTok of how this rules committee made its decision, as well as maybe a ref's perspective on what these rule changes mean. But Quint, to set the table, what was your reaction when you started to hear rumblings and then the finality of what came to fruition on Friday?
I was impressed because I really felt that they were going to go with a 30-second clear clock and maybe a 90 or 75-second shot clock. So they took a very aggressive and progressive stand here and really took a quantum leap forward in my eyes with the way the shot clock mechanism is now going to work. You know, I think it'll be executed simply on the field, but where the refs are controlling the 20, you know, on a beeper or whatever, or count, and then, you know, signaling the shot clock and getting that on TV in the stadium on the clocks going should be relatively simple. I hope we can pull that off. You know, I can't tell you how many times, Terry, when I meet friends who broadcast, whether it's football, basketball, wrestling, hockey, soccer, or whatever, and they say to me, yeah, I watched that lacrosse game. It looks pretty good. Where's the shot clock? You know, we're living in an era where people want action, where we're trying to get games done faster with more activity, less downtime. And so I think this helps. There's a lot of issues now that the coaches and players are going to have to deal with going forward, and we can talk about those as this goes on. But I applaud the committee for their aggressive stance and basically taking a quantum leap forward when in the past we've taken just absolute baby steps year in and year out. So I give them really two thumbs up and tremendously excited to see how this is going to work.
So I do not give them two thumbs up. I am more reserved in my judgment, and I'll explain why. But I do want to echo your point that I thought that the aggregate decisions suggest a real aggressiveness from the seven or so folks who were involved in the voting, as well as the, you know, roughly one dozen or so who were actually involved in the conversation. But heading into this process, I advocated for one main point of view. I want the rule structure of the game to be as overall simple as possible. And I don't think that this is as simple as possible. I think the separation of a possession clock and a clearing clock still is more complicated than it needs to be. The 1B bullet point that I said is the only outcome that I would have resisted, because I didn't really have a strong opinion about any of the durations. We talked about 60, 75, 90, whatever. I didn't really care about any of that. The only thing I cared about was that a clearing clock ought to be included in a overall possession clock, and it should start when the defending team gets possession of the ball. And there are two main reasons I feel this way. To the point about simplicity, it's the way that every other sport works. Every other sport starts its shot clock when the defense gets possession in its own end. And then secondly, because I believe, and this is where I'm taking more of a middle ground approach, I am willing to wait and see before I say this was a bad choice or this is a bad rule.
But correct. I believe. No, I agree with that.
I believe that when you give a team a clearing clock that is separate from its possession clock, you disincentivize their willingness to push transition in this way. So if you think that the overall value of possession is the asset, if I try to run a fast break that takes me 4 seconds to cross the midline, the total length of my possession is 64 seconds. If I slowly clear and substitute to get my offensive personnel on and it takes me 18 seconds to get over the midline, I have a 78-second possession. It rewards teams for clearing slowly by giving them longer possessions. That's my main point.
I hear your point. Okay, I hear your point, and I kind of agree with it, but after talking to some people in Major League Lacrosse, they think the biggest issue that this changes the game is that 20-second clear clock to midline. 20 seconds is fast, okay? This is going to reward teams who can ride. This is going to reward two-way middies and goaltenders who can outlet and get the ball out fast. Because if you make a save, take the ball behind the goal, throw the ball into the corner to a defender who then has to throw a cross-field pass, all of a sudden you're looking at 10 seconds remaining on the clearing clock, okay? This is going to really change the way teams have to get out. And I don't think you can be patient with a 20-second clearing clock. I think you got to get out. You got to have poles who can handle. You're not going to be able to sub that second pole off like so many teams do. I think your LSM, if he can handle, he's got to stay on. But most likely he'll run off. You're too short, he's got to sit down. Multiple cross fields will lead to tons and tons of clearing violations. Now, what that's going to do is create absolute chaos on restarts, and it's going to be so fun to watch. Failure to clear, drop the ball, boom, fast whistle. Here they come back down your throat, 3-on-2, 4-on-3. So I think that's the biggest change here. In terms of the 60, I don't see – it's basically having a timer on every possession, and that's going to increase the amount of possessions. If you watched Big Ten lacrosse last year, chart it, look it up. The possessions per game in that conference were so dreadful. I mean, I covered the Hopkins-Maryland game 8-7. Everyone said, oh, what a great game it was. I thought it was a stinker. You know, when you're dealing with such few possessions, I just find it hard to watch. So in my eyes, Terry, I hear your point. But 20 is too short of a time to dilly-dally. It's really too short of a time to try to get full three subs on and off. So I think this is going to reward teams who can handle out of their own end and teams who can ride, maybe back up initially and then press down. The other thing it's going to change is once I clear it, okay, I get the ball to the midfield line, the 60 starts. What's your tack defensively? You're probably best off that if you're in a position of strength, if you've got your right personnel on the field defensively, you may as well press out early, and you can chew 5, 10, 15 seconds of the initial shot clock while the offense is not set up yet. So, you know, like Virginia likes to press after they carry over the midfield line. That's a good time to earn some time defensively.
I agree with those points, and that's ultimately why I'm not really bummed out by this outcome. I do think that there will be some chaos created by this that will be fun and exciting. I do think my point about the fact that this is not the simplest solution remains, because ultimately, if the argument is that 20 seconds is quick to clear, they could have accomplished that by making this an 80-second possession clock that starts with 60 at any point. So you have to clear in 20 seconds.
Yes, and I think we took a step in the right direction, but maybe it's not the perfect step. And I do agree with your point. You know, I too am in favor of one clock for simplicity. Obviously, we have new viewers on TV. Explaining these intricacies can be a little challenging, okay? So you put 80 up. Once they bring it over the midfield line, they can't bring it back over. So you have a back court. So that really kind of shrinks the field in terms of late game stalling. And we've argued about this in the past. I'm not opposed to a team being able to use the entire field to stall late in a game. I mean, soccer does it. Basketball's got a half court issue. You know, like lacrosse, that's probably what we should be doing. So I do favor a one clock scenario. Simplicity is critical in the game, but they took a step forward. Now, and we'll see how this works out, because the 20 is going to be fast, and teams who can't handle in their own zone are going to really be penalized for it.
So two comments there. One, I heard some grousing from head Division I coaches about the lack of being able to see the clearing clock, which doesn't totally ring true to me, given the fact that you can't see it now, and it doesn't seem to present that many problems. I do agree with them that had it been included in the overall possession clock, that issue would not be available. Like, you would know that I need to get over the midline by 70 seconds left on the clock or whatever else. But to the point about 20 seconds being fast, you will have a better sense of this because it's a little bit before my time. So in the initial period of when I was following college lacrosse, say, I think it was up to 2005, teams had about, I believe it was 10 seconds to cross their own defensive restraining line.
Yeah, I played in that
between,
era. That's right.
They were untimed between their restraining line and the midline, and then once they crossed, they had 10 or 15 seconds to get it from the midline into the restraining box. Then there was a four-year intermediate period between those rules and the rules that we've had for the last 10 years or so, where I believe the rule was 20 seconds to cross the midline, and then it was untimed to step in the box, and then it was weird. But I think that we've had this 20 seconds to cross the midline before. Does that ring a bell?
Well, not really. I mean, I went from the no-clock era where I could make a save and circle the goal 16 times. There was no time limit. And at any time we had a lead, I'd kill 20 to 30 seconds with the ball behind the net and just walk it up and take it slow. And then they changed that and made us clear. We had to get out of our own box in 10. So it was like a sprint and then stop. And then you had three quarters of the field to operate. You had 60 yards, you know, you had restraining line to mid to restraining to end line to operate. And then you went slow from there. And the restraining lines, quite honestly, are worthless. And they're only there to keep players, to tell them where to line up for a faceoff. So I'm glad we got rid of that, anything associated with touch it in.
Let's talk about zone defense, because that's one of the things that I heard as a big detractor or counterpoint to the value of a shot clock, was that teams are going to pack in and play zone and whatever else. I don't buy it. What do you think?
Well, you're going to see two strategies late in a shot clock. You're going to see either a press out where I get on your hands, I stretch adjacent, and so I strangle an offense in the last 10 seconds of a shot clock. Or you'll see the second. You have a good goalie, you have a lengthy, rangy defense. You could pack it in a zone and put more pressure on the team to score from 15+. Here's the deal, though. 60 seconds is going to create some different scenarios now. Okay, efficient offenses get rewarded. Well-coached offenses get rewarded. Well-coached defenses do also. I think the biggest thing here that's going under the radar so far is how much this helps a defense like Notre Dame. I mean, you think about Notre Dame's defense, how good they are in that first 30 to 45 seconds. When they're lined up, their integrity's good. You know, they don't have to deal with those minute and a half, 2 minute possessions. I mean, you think about Maryland's offense and their inability to score in the first 45 seconds until they wear you down and get you tired and change the matchups. I just think this really helps good defenses. It also brings, you know, latent shot clock scenarios in mind. Okay, playmakers are going to be rewarded. You're going to see some bad shots being taken late in the shot clock that missed the goal. You're going to see restarts on the end line with 10 to go in the shot clock. Okay, what do? You roll the ball in the corner, or do you have an ex-attackman who can create an advantage? Do you have an inside presence, whether it's a Canadian finisher or somebody who can catch everything that's thrown to him, jam the ball inside? So that position now all of a sudden becomes rewarded. And then do you have a bomber from the outside? You have someone who can hit a step down, who can be a presence from 14 or 15 off of that X move. So I think you're going to see a lot of new scenarios late in shot clocks. How does the defense play it? Do they zone it up when the ball goes out of bounds? Do you press out on the X guy? Does the X guy create an advantage? The ability, short time plays also, you know, inside games, whether it's fish hooks, picks, all sorts of stuff. So I think it creates a lot of coachable scenarios. And for coaches who feel that they've lost control, I say the opposite. There's going to be more possessions. There's going to be more coachable moments in these games.
I have a similar point of view in two senses. Number one, that comment bothers me. The decrying zone defense comment bothers me because, first of all, I don't think zone defense is inherently bad. People like watching Syracuse basketball, and they know that their 2-3 zone is a hallmark identity marker of the program. And number two, I don't think that offense has to look ugly against a zone. I mean, really the principles are you got to move the ball quickly from side to side to get the zone moving to create seams that can be attacked either by dodging or shooting. So I think that that's a little bit, I don't know, that always rung hollow to me.
One negative I would add to a zone, Terry, is it's tough to clear out of a zone. It's tough to inbounds clear out of a zone because, honestly, all your players are inside the defense, inside the offensive shell, and to get a quick out is difficult. So if I make a save and we're in a zone D, it's a little hard. My initial looks aren't going to be as clear. Okay, I got to be more patient as a goalie throwing my outlets. I got to let my offensive players, my breakout guys, find seams and bubbles, as opposed to man. Especially we've slid. All of a sudden, we got two guys up by the shooter. One of them's wide open. It's an easy look. So your clearing out of a zone is a lot more difficult and usually a little slower to develop.
One of the things that is interesting about this conversation is the presence, or it's not even presence. It's almost like it's existing. It's lingering in the background, this idea of a two-point line. And I'm told by folks who are part of the conversation within the Rules Committee that it did not come up in this meeting. I did talk to Seth Tierney, the head coach at Hofstra and assistant coach at the U.S. national team yesterday, and he basically said, in his point of view, the presence of a shot clock should bring with it a two-point line. And, you know, more than anything else, that comment suggested to me or shed light to me that, you know, I think I tweeted this last week. After we wrote that story that, you know, basically highlighted John Donowski's letter to the Division I head coaches, I had more guys reach out to me to talk about rules than I have for any other story that I've written in the 10 years that I've worked at Inside Lacrosse. So the point is that guys care about this, and they all have their own opinion, and their opinions they tend to be very, very different. But relative to the two-point line in particular, my attitude is that this shot clock, this standardized possession clock, which I still do not think is perfect, is the outcome of a 10-year evolution. I'm okay with a two-point line being a part of that evolution and being a consideration 2, 4, or 6 years from now when we analyze what does this set of rules do for the game and what needs to be done to enhance or make a more perfect game.
Yeah, I mean, listening to college coaches talk about these rules, I kind of tread in a different – I like to pursue a different direction. I like to talk to guys like Dave Cottle, Tony Seaman, Jim Stagnita, Bear Davis, and the dozens of assistant coaches right now like Will Manny, John Hawes, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, who have played under both rules, who have coached under both rules. Those are our experts. No offense to John Donowski and Charlie Toomey, whose comments were pretty polarizing recently. They don't have the experience or the track record to make those comments, quite honestly. And so I trust a guy like Dave Cottle, 28 years of NCAA lacrosse, 8 years in Major League lacrosse. He knows the rules back and forth. And as part of the process for this committee, I sure hope they reached out to those gentlemen and got their feedback. We have also 18 years of MLL analytics to go by. What works, what doesn't work. And I sure hope that they looked at those numbers and that data to form their decisions.
All right, Quint, you talked about end of shot clock scenarios, and I think the calculus on that was dramatically changed when, on Friday afternoon, word started to trickle out and Inside Lacrosse first reported that the crease dive is coming back. This took me by surprise. Again, to reference a comment that I had made leading up to this Rules Committee conversation, I said, in the wake of both the Maryland-Denver 2017 NCAA semifinal that had two controversial in the crease, out of the crease, should the goal be allowed or not calls, and then the FI World Championships that included so many college coaches where the dive is allowed, and it was a big presence. And that obviously goes hand-in-hand with the fact that it's legal in MLL and NLL as well. I guess through that lens, it shouldn't be a surprise that the dive came back. That being said, I was surprised. And I think that ultimately, again, it changes the calculus for the end of the shot clock because, you know, if you back up a shot with 5 seconds to go, traditionally that would be a roll the ball into the corner, set up your ride, and try to get the ball back, make it as difficult for them to clear as possible scenario. Now, you might tell the guy that's restarting with the ball, go to the goal and try to make something happen because you can end up in the crease. What was your reaction to it?
The dive being back dramatically changes the geometry. You said calculus. It's the geometry of offense, and it opens so much now for wing dodgers and X dodgers and their ability to air gate or a wing dodger to go underneath and then dive across the tangent of the crease. And defenders have, for the last decade or so, have been able to sit on that top shoulder and force guys underneath. they can't do that as much now. So it really opens up your ability as a wing dodger to drive topside, get that defender to overplay you, and then beeline it back to the crease and fly across the face of the crease. It also will test these goalies. You know, there are times when a guy's going to dive. I got to beat him to the spot. I got to beat him to goal line extended. I got to beat him to the tangent of the crease and be that seventh defender. And also, you know, I like the rule they put in that if you dive towards the goal line, if you put a goalie at risk, you should be penalized. So, I think they got that right, and that's a tremendous, tremendous opening for us in terms of television and showing highlights. I can't tell you, when I cover an MLL game, there's usually one dive highlight per game that makes me say, wow, like, did you see that? That was incredible.
So my attitude, and I want to include this in the conversation with Shrinking the Subbox, because both of these were originally made with an eye toward player safety. To your comment about what it means for the goalie, yeah, I think that the rule should be much more objective. If the offensive player makes contact with the goalie, the goal should be disallowed. How do you feel about that?
I mean, I can initiate contact.
That is a judgment call that can be made by the referee. If the goalie initiates contact, it's not. But if the offensive player initiates contact with the goalie, that I think putting the goalie at risk is too subjective of a term. I think that it should be boiled down to, if the offensive player makes contact with the goalie, then the goal should be disallowed. And if it's egregious, then it should be a 1 minute, and it looks like it will be a 1 minute penalty.
The scenarios that scare me typically are the ones where the guy leaves his feet, he's hit by a defender and then changes direction in the air, or a defender, you know, where you have that third party who's kind of standing around, whether it's a goalie or another defender, and then they have their legs undercut. Those are the scenarios that really scare me.
So that one, and then originally the substitution box was expanded so as to create more room for players running on and off to not collide. I didn't really get that when it was put into place, because I had never seen a significant collision at the sub box. But now to shrink it back from 10 yards on each side of the midline to 5 yards on each side of the midline, it seems like the biggest implementation of that, or the biggest outcome, is going to be the strategic advantage of how far, you know, now having 5 additional yards to run as you get back on defense. So basically, it used to be that if you were subbing off offensive personnel on the front door and then subbing defensive personnel on the back door, you were picking up 20 yards, and now you're picking up 10 yards.
Very significant.
As that guy is trying to get back into the hole and decrease transition. You are a believer that this is going to be a significantly meaningful change, correct?
I think it could add a 6-on-5 or 5-on-4, you know, 1 or 2 a game. And teams now, you know, can't rely on that box to pick up 20 yards defensively to sub out and then in. So I think that's a positive, and we just got to have good box decorum. The rules are the rules. The guy coming off has it right away. Let's not be jerks in the box. And I think this will encourage teams to push it 5-on-4, 6-on-5.
My sympathy to all the table staffs out there who now have to look over the player's bench in order to see the goal, in order to know who scored and who assisted. But Quint, all of these rule changes are subject to approval from the prop committee that will review these proposals on September 12th, and then we will know definitively what rules are in place for the 2019 season. I will remind everyone that in 2000, a shot clock was initially approved coming away from these meetings and then scrapped due to feedback that it was going to be an untenable or unsustainable situation heading into the 2001 season. So we're not all the way out of the woods yet, but certainly a lot of progress made over the course of the last 3 days in Indianapolis.
And the same thing could happen this year. And it's interesting that the date's September 12th, because I wouldn't be surprised if some teams are actually starting practice prior to September 12th. And there's never been a more important fall in terms of preparation and getting practice time and in rehearsing these. This is quite a shift that puts a lot of work on the part of coaches and veteran players, and now new players from high school. This fall is really, really important, because, you know, we're playing so much February lacrosse right now, and you can't afford to have a 3 or 4 game lapse at the beginning of next season where you're not accustomed to the flow of these games. So this fall is probably the most critical fall that I've been around, because of these changes.
And the Inside Lacrosse Emergency Rule Change Edition podcast continues with Isle Editor-in-Chief Matt Kinnear, who was manning the battle stations on Friday as news started to trickle out. Matt, on Thursday night, we started to hear some rumors from Indianapolis. Nothing felt confirmed, and also there were a couple of votes that remained. But we had an idea that it was going to be this 20-second clearing clock into a 60-second shot clock. And then it was Paul Rabil, of all people, who tweeted that it was, I don't know if official is the right word, but it was at least enough that we were good to go on. What was it like being at the command post on Friday, one of the most significant days in the history of men's college lacrosse?
Yeah, it's a mix of kind of stressful, but also kind of dead in a weird way. There's a lot of sitting around and you know, waiting for that one more confirmation before you can go with something. You know, like you said, we had a pretty good idea that it was the 20-second clear to midline and then the 60-second shot clock. We were kind of hoping for one more source on that. You know, we had multiple inside the cross reporters who had heard that from Indianapolis. But, you know, when Paul tweeted that out, you know, that was kind of our it verified what we already knew in some degree. But it was really exciting. You know, it was kind of tense, and there's that just odd feeling of just not knowing what's going to happen, but having an idea of what's going to happen. And then when it all kind of shook out, like, it really did feel like a historic day. You know, being a summer Friday, you know, there's not a ton of people in the office. You know, it's not like it's in the show, the newsroom, where there's people running around like crazy. It's nothing like that at all. It's a lot of text messages, a lot of phone calls. But it really certainly felt like a momentous day in the sport of college lacrosse.
What was your personal reaction to the rules, both as, you know, they started to piecemeal come out, and then also finally once the announcement was released, we knew what was official, and you were able to kind of digest everything?
They, on one hand, I'm not surprised by the spirit of what the committee did, in the sense that, you know, the shot clock seemed inevitable. You know, I had a little bit of doubt earlier in the week that maybe, you know, there'd be some cold feet and there wouldn't be a shot clock in this cycle. And the dive, you know, also is a thing that just more and more as the days kind of got closer to Indianapolis heard might be a reality of what's to come. But I was surprised at the method of the shot clock being the 20 seconds to clear to midline and then the 60 second shot clock after that. First of all, 60 seconds, just did not expect to see that number in any kind of capacity there. But really, I thought for sure it was going to be a shot clock on possession. Mirror, you know, most every other sport that has a shot clock. That really seemed to be, as much as there's not a consensus among the coaches of the method of the shot clock, that seemed to be the one that had the most consensus. It seemed to be a conservative way to go about adding a standard shot clock. So I thought that there would be that kind of more conservative starting point with that, and then maybe as time went on, they would inch that down to 75 seconds or 60 seconds. So I was a little shocked to see the way that they put in the shot clock.
Yeah, I share that point of view. I also, as I just explained to Quint, was a little bit disappointed to see it because of my attitude of what it potentially does to transition. And that's mitigated by a few conversations that I had that, you know, basically if coaches don't like something, I'm like, ooh, okay, well, maybe we got something interesting here. And I had a few of those. What were your reactions, or what were your conversations about reacting to the rule changes like?
It's funny, the handful of people that I talked to throughout the day Friday, you know, this was kind of before everything was officially announced, but then also after things were officially announced, and everyone kind of knew what was going on at that point. You know, I talked to a lot of guys who were pretty staunch supporters of a shot clock, you know, and I purposely reached out to those guys to see what they had to say, and it was kind of a similar vibe. They were like, that isn't exactly what I wanted. What was the thing that kind of overwhelmingly I heard from them, but they were still excited. You know, they're like, yeah, this wasn't exactly 100% what I wanted. You know, I wanted the shot clock on possession, or, you know, I wanted something a little more conservative, but they're still excited and they're still really happy that the committee took a bold step. They're really more excited, I think, with the spirit of what the committee did, the fact that they were willing to take this step into the shot clock and not kind of make another half measure or, you know, put it off for another 2 years with experimental rules. So I think it was more overwhelmingly like, I'm glad we did something. It wasn't quite what I wanted, but hey, I'm going to work with it. I'm a coach. I'm going to figure it out. And Terry, to your point about killing transition, I agree with you, but I also am a little skeptical of coaches trying to purposely not clear quickly, if that makes any sense. I just don't know if if coaches feel that comfortable to say, hey, I'm going to wait 18 seconds to cross this midline, you know, when they have a chance to do it right away. I'm not sure that's going to be as much of a concern as maybe I even initially thought.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think that that's, you know, kind of why I'm taking a wait and see approach to what the final product is. It's the balance of how much does a coach weigh the benefit of having his full six offensive personnel for the full 60 seconds versus the risk of a failure to advance because of a concession made in the clear. And I think it's really difficult to know right now what the approach is going to be, but then it's pretty clear that the approach is going to change both as they get feedback and as they and their teams get better at managing these scenarios and situations. So looking back and thinking about preparing for this news event, for lack of a better word, you know, it was interesting how we transitioned out of the World Games as being kind of the main focus of our content into a little bit of the end of July equaling the end of the recruiting calendar. And then all of a sudden, the rule changes were kind of here. And the conversation really got tipped off in a meaningful way by a letter that John Donowski sent to coaches after his experience coaching, number one, Duke to the national championship game, number two, playing under MLL rules in the MLL All-Star game with the U.S. national team, and then number three, his experience coaching eight games with the U.S. team in Israel against or under FIL rules. And his letter, you know, kind of honed the focus about 10 days out. You know, it allowed us to get more reactions included into a story and then kind of aggregate and repost all the content that we had done in preparation of this, over the years in preparation of the idea of a shot clock. Over the last 2 weeks, how have you seen the conversation evolve, particularly through the lens of InsideLacrosse.com?
You know, Terry, it's funny you said the phrase over the years, because really this is, for us, you know, we've been preparing for this moment for, I mean, in reality, almost 20 years. But, you know, kind of more pointedly, you know, I look at the 2017 national semifinals with Bill Tierney saying, you know, we need to bring the dive back and we need to have a shot clock in men's lacrosse. Bill Tierney says something, you have to imagine that it's going to happen. You know, so really that's kind of a good starting point. But we've done so much of the legwork for this that really the past 2 weeks was just kind of honing in and getting those last, you know, trying to get the vibe of like, all right, is this going to be something that actually happens, or is this just a lot of talk and a lot of posturing over the past few years? You know, so when it comes down to it, you know, last fall, we asked tons of coaches when they came into our Inside the Cross offices during the IMLCA convention what they thought about the shot clock. And overwhelmingly, you know, we thought it was going to happen then, and we reported that then. You know, in the same time, we had Patrick McEwen, you know, did a probably the most thorough thing that's ever been done on the shot clock. And there's a lot of interesting stuff in there, even though they didn't really go with the method that he kind of proposed as the ideal shot clock. There's a lot of information about possession times, you know, evidence from women's lacrosse, from MLL. That's really kind of been the definitive post for the shot clock. And then it was kind of getting a little bit of the other side. Andrew Giesen from Monmouth, you know, I think his point was excellent about kind of the defense of the status quo was the headline on that story. So we gathered up all those opinions, but we've had those for the last year and a half, 2 years, already kind of ready to go. So it's kind of been just like, all right, what's going to be, we know what people want, at least what the data says that people want. We've given all the sides of the story. Now what's actually going to happen? And kind of, I made the comment to you, and I made it to a few coaches when the John Donowski letter came out, you know, man, I wonder if just all of the stuff that's happened over the past 2 years, if when it comes down to it, they're just going to have cold feet. You know, they're just going to want to put it, you know, kick the can down the road a few more years because, hey, the game isn't broken. You know, the game is in a pretty good space. So why do something that could have, you know, the unintended consequences that people talk about?
Well, and interestingly, so, to clearly, that point specifically, sitting on the sidelines of the Under Armour Underclass Tournament with Lars Tiffany, who was a member of this rules committee, you know, he voiced an interesting perspective, which is that there are a number of new faces on this committee. Are they going to feel emboldened, given the authority, such as it's their position, because they're new to this job, to make a drastic change? You know, it wasn't a pronouncement. It was an expression of doubt, or at least the consideration. And ultimately, it proved not to be the case. You know, there was clearly, to your point, a lot of action
coming from this group.
And Terry, when you look at the makeup of this committee, maybe we should have knew that all along. You know, I think it's some progressive lacrosse minds who are in that room. You know, people who are willing to be a little bit individualistic, do things their way. You look at, you know, the D1 representatives, Lars Tiffany and John Basti specifically. Those are two of the teams that, you know, play the fastest in college lacrosse. They play with reckless abandon. They play in a way that, you know, maybe makes a lot of other, maybe makes 68 other coaches in the country uncomfortable, the way that they, you know, just run up and down the field. You know, so maybe we should have kind of known that was coming. And then another thing when you're talking about content, Terry, was, you know, conversations with Dom Starja and Don Zimmerman, you know, I've had in the past 2 weeks have really kind of given me a lot of respect for these guys on the committee. Don Zimmerman, you know, I talked about the process with them, you know, so it was a little bit more about just like, what it's like in the room, you know, what are the conversations like? Does it get heated? You know, is it respectful? And, you know, he really cleared those up on a podcast last week. And then just Dom Starja, you know, I think kind of put into perspective from a historical sense, as he always does, what it means and what the kind of duty to serve that these guys have. And he wrote that on InsideLacrosse.com. So that kind of shaped, you know, maybe some of my thoughts heading into that final push for the meetings in Indianapolis.
So the moment comes at about 1:15, Paul Rabel tweets, "Congratulations, college lacrosse. 20 seconds to get over the equator, then 60-second shot clock will begin. Any reset will reset to 60, cleaner than having 90 seconds of running clock via RPD with lacrosse. Excited to watch. We just got better." Not the way that I think any of us expected this conversation to get tipped off, but I think the line is pretty clear. Ryan Danahy served as a volunteer to Mike Murphy the last two seasons. Mike Murphy, the head men's lacrosse coach at Penn, also serving on the Rules Committee. Ryan Danahy, also the offensive coordinator for the New York Lizards, the team for which Paul Rabel plays and is getting ready for the ML semifinals. My presumption is that those guys were together yesterday as news started to trickle out. We were in a position to have a story ready pretty quickly, but obviously there's always, you know, when you have a story that's prepared to go but is waiting on details, my concern is always, is there one thing that we wrote that it didn't come to fruition? It isn't true. What was your, I guess, level of anxiety when you pressed published on our story?
I was certain of it. You know, I think like you said, that kind of clear line that, you know, Paul Rabel's tweet had to the committee, and, you know, it was a different line than, you know, different sourcing than we had. So I kind of treated that as another verification of stuff that we already knew and were pretty certain about to begin with. But it, you know, just kind of makes you a little less anxious every other time you have something confirming that. Plus conversations with other coaches throughout the day. You know, it seemed that word was trickling out about what was happening with the Rules Committee. But also, again, you know, this is something that the NCAA was going to announce it. I'd rather be right, and it's just announced at, you know, 4 p.m. or whatever the NCAA comes out, than try to rush out something that's not really, you know, what purpose does it really serve to kind of rush out something that's not correct when this is something that's really serious and people's jobs and livelihoods are at stake with these rules and what they mean?
Well, and then it ultimately ended up, you know, being incomplete insofar as a couple hours later, I was sitting in traffic waiting to get over the Bay Bridge. And at about 5 to 4, I got a text message saying there's more. And it turned out that more was the return of the crease dive. So the story needs to be updated once again to say that, hey, the rule changes did not end with the institution of a shot clock. And certainly, you know, this is a story that you have dived into.
A nice pun.
Yes. pretty ardently, given that, you know, you kind of took the other end of the spectrum. Typically, the dive is a celebrated move. It's one of the things that is romanticized about lacrosse. But it doesn't come without a cost. I think that there's reasonable questions to be asked with around how frequent are injuries resulting from the dive, but they're not. It's greater than zero. We'll say that. So, what was your reaction? And now, as you think about what it means in the context of all of these changes, are you pleased? Are you excited? Are you glad that the dive is back?
It's funny, Terry. You and I were on a text message chain with a coach earlier that day who said, I think the dive is coming back. And, you know, it wasn't anyone who I necessarily thought had inside info, but it was just kind of funny that turned out to be true just a few hours later. You know, I'm not trying to give a middleman answer here, but I really don't have a strong opinion one way or the other on the dive. I do think that people who discount the injuries aspect are, you know, they're putting blinders on something that is actually a reality. You know, a lot of time, the reason I did the story that you're referring to, you know, we had it titled The Other Side of the Dive. It's Alex Krawek. You know, he was a goalie at Lemoyne, a fantastic goalie, an All-American goalie. And, you know, he's a guy who won national championships. Starting out his MLL career in training camp, you know, he was kind of on the other side of the dive, broke his leg in three different places, and essentially stopped his playing career from there. Not only did it stop his playing career, but he had, you know, jobs lined up that was going to basically be him, you know, teaching how to play goalie. And, you know, he had just a lot of things that required his physicality in order to kind of feed his livelihood. And then this happened, you know, he can't play anymore. He can't coach and teach anymore. It really changes the trajectory of his life. So I just think people need to realize that, you know, I've always heard this kind of saying that, like, I've never actually heard of anyone who got hurt from a dive. It's something that we heard so many times before I did that story. So I just wanted to share that, like, no, this is a reality and this can happen. So, you know, don't discount that. That being said, I do think it's kind of a rarity, and I do think it's one of the most exciting plays in the sport. I feel like the kind of, you know, the rallying call, bring back the dive, you know, shout out elacrosse.com from back in the day. You know, I think that's died down in recent years to some extent, because there's so many other athletic plays all over the field. So to me, it was actually a little bit anticlimactic that the dive came back, which I wasn't really expecting. I thought it was going to be a little more of kind of a celebration. But to me, it's, you know, there is another side to it. You know, there are people can get hurt. I do think it's a really exciting play, so I'm glad to see it back overall, I think. But two coaches to me yesterday shared with me an idea that it was John Svek who proposed this in 2007, I believe, in one of the committee meetings, that they make another crease within the crease that you can dive, but if you land within that line, then it's not a goal. If you're outside of it, then it is a goal. So I think there is still some discussion, and we might see some tweaks on that over the next few years as well.
All right, Matt. Well, the last one I wanted to kind of gauge from your perspective was the reaction to this. So, you know, I started by saying one of the most momentous days in college lacrosse history. Did it feel like that on social media?
You know, probably not as much as the rule cycle in 2012-13.
I would agree with that.
If I'm being honest. Which I was a little surprised for, but I think it's been such a, you know, if you use that as one, maybe the starting point for this, even though I think the starting point probably goes back even further than that, there's been incremental steps toward this. And with some of the reporting that we've done, especially, you know, when you look at November of 2017, I think is when we really kind of really pounded the pavement on this story and really hit it home that, yes, a shot clock is going to come very soon. I don't think it was all that surprising when it actually happened. So I don't think it quite hit that, you know, 12-13 level of, you know, when those rules changed. And also remember, that's when the motorcycle grip was banned, but then also reinstated. If there was some significant changes to the face-off crew, you know, the most vocal crew on social media, we definitely would have had that same vibe. But without there being really, you know, anything significant dealing with the face-off, this kind of being inevitable that the shot clock was going to happen, just kind of a more of a question of how. You know, it didn't certainly feel as crazy on social media. And actually, I thought, you know, some of the dissenting opinions were very respectful and kind of kept in mind that, hey, this committee has a really difficult job to do. They certainly have the best interest of the game in mind. You know, it might not be perfect, but hey, we respect the fact that they sat in that room. They don't have to do this. It's a volunteer position. And, you know, they're working just like we are to make the game better.
All right. Well, Matt, we appreciate your time and insight. Kudos to a job well done. Enjoy the rest of the weekend.
Thanks, you too.
And the Inside Lacrosse podcast, emergency edition, the rules have changed, continues with Mark Dixon, Inside Lacrosse and Big Ten Network analyst, as well as a longtime official of pretty much every level. So, Mark, you can speak to these rules in a very meaningful way. But before we dive into the nuance from an official's perspective, generally speaking, how was your reaction to Friday's news?
Very, very surprised. I was very surprised at the aggressiveness of the shot clock. I didn't think it was going to be 60 seconds. I really did think it was going to be a straight 90 from all the coaches that I've spoken with over the last few weeks. So I was really surprised at that. Surprised that they shrunk the substitution box. And pretty surprised that they brought the dive back. So my overall reaction initially was surprise to all of the major parameters that have been put forth by the Rules Committee.
For whatever lack of consensus there was, be it among college coaches or, you know, lacrosse constituents more at large, it seemed like the two most popular goals heading into this Rules Committee meeting were A, streamlining the ref's responsibility, aka making it easier, and B, which is like kind of A, but also a little bit different, removing the subjectivity from the official's hands. Do you think that this set of rule changes effectively accomplished that goal?
Yeah, I guess I should probably rewind a little bit and say I was surprised at the duration of the shot clock. I knew a shot clock. Actually, it was more like a 50-50 after conversations with coaches, because some coaches said it's either going to be nothing and some coaches said it's going to be 90. And to get the in-between and the lower of the in-between was what I was so surprised with. But to answer your question, those two go hand in hand to make the referee's job easier and then therefore taking the subjectivity out of the shot clock that we've had the last couple of years. I think both of them have been accomplished. I do. And I say that because you and I have spoken about this. I've spoken about it with a lot of other people as well. It was maybe 5-6 years ago, I officiated a fall ball game at Stevenson where they used this mechanism of shot clock, the 20 second to clear and 60 seconds to shoot. And I thought it was great. The pace of play was fantastic. The flow of the game was great. But again, it's a fall ball game, so there's really nothing at stake. And that's what I kind of pushed for, was if we ever have a shot clock, let's have a clearing mechanism in there. I was met with a lot of opposition. I rethought it, and I'm like, okay, maybe a straight, 60, 80, 90, maybe that's the way to go. So when I saw that the committee put this in, right away I put on my referee hat, and I'm like, okay, this does make the ref's job easier because they're already using the timer, the buzzer, it's on their belts for the 20 second. And now with the clearing mechanism being put in place, when that buzzer goes off, game over. If you either got it over the midline or you don't. And if you do, then your 60 starts. If you don't, we're turning it over and going the other way. So I think that does make it easier. And then, of course, the shot clock in and of itself, once you cross the midfield line, it's completely out of the referee's hands. The 20 second is something that we've been doing for years, really for decades now. And then the shot clock itself takes care of its own once it crosses the midline. You have a shot clock operator that puts up a straight 60. It's not the judgment of the officials. And so on both those fronts, I think it's good.
So the clearing clock was something that I think probably got the most negative reaction, whether it be among coaches or fans, when it was announced yesterday. I've already expressed on this podcast my opinion toward that and why. But there are a couple things about the actual way that the clearing clock is adjudicated that I think it would be helpful to understand what this could potentially allow for. So first things first, the way that it was explained to me is that one of the benefits, or maybe one of the concerns about going to a straight possession clock, was the efficacy of starting the possession clock on time, particularly if it is visible, particularly if it takes a shot clock operator who is not on the field in order to start that possession clock. The concern was that play was going to have to be halted in order to adjust the start of the shot clock in order to be an appropriate, say, 90 seconds from the beginning of possession. This allows the tradition, the in-place mechanism of a official starting the clearing clock when the defensive team gains possession. It's almost like nothing changes. I had a couple coaches express to me concern over the fact that the clock is invisible, which I don't really buy because it's invisible right now. However, their point was that if it were incorporated into an overall possession clock, I'd be able to see, basically, say we get 90 seconds and then you have to clear the midline by 70. I can look up, my team can look up and see 70 seconds on the clock, or 71, and we know that we have to get the ball over in 1 second. Can't do that now. Okay, that's fine. The other is, I was told, what happens if, you know, there are refs carrying multiple clocks and they don't align? One guy says failure to advance, the other guy doesn't. I'm like, that doesn't muster with me either, because that's not how it works. So can you explain how the 20-second clearing clock works now, or how you envision that it will work in the implementation of these rules?
I think to answer that question, there's a couple things to consider. One, this isn't just for Division I, and it's not just for the Division I programs that are on television. So I think that sometimes fans, other individuals involved in the sport, you know, kind of think those rules are only for that set because that's what we see. This is for everything in lacrosse. This is Divisions 1, 2, and 3, the junior college level, everything associated with college lacrosse. So you're going to get variances of facilities, resources, game personnel, all those things that have to be taken into consideration. But to answer your question, the mechanic for starting the clearing clock, just imagine the white team is on offense, blue team's playing defense. You're looking out on the field right in front of you as a coach. You've got the trail official in front of you. You've got the goal official down in the vicinity of goal line extended. Then on the far side, you have the single side referee straddling, you know, kind of in between, forming that triangle that we've all kind of come accustomed to seeing when we watch games. The goaltender for the defensive team makes a save, or a defender picks the ball up. The goal official then will do the right-handed twirl with the index finger, letting everybody know that possession has changed hands and it's now time to start the clearing clock. The single side always has responsibility for that clearing clock. So that individual he is the only one in a good crew, in an experienced crew, in a competent crew. He's the only one. Okay. So he'll hit his buzzer. And then the mechanic is, unless the play is right in front of him and some action or foul or some type of need for him to step in will be called, his job is to get to the cone at the midline in some semblance of fashion. And once there, the clock's, you know, his beeper is still going, and he has responsibility for the clearing clock as well as now offsides. And then obviously once that buzzer hits and you can hear that high pitch, then that manual chop starts. So that is the mechanic for administering the clearing clock. Now, of course, with the new suggested rules, the chop goes out because it's a 20-second clearing clock. Look, every coach has different experiences. Every coach has different levels of sophistication when it comes to their resources and game personnel, et cetera. But overall, I don't buy that. I'm with you in that. There could be some hiccups with the shot clock per se. I reffed the fall ball game last year, and they used a 90-second straight possession clock. The person administering, and this was at a Division I school, the person administering and operating the shot clock, possession clock, if you will, it was not only new to that, but it was their first lacrosse game ever, watching lacrosse ever. And as you can imagine, there were some errors during the game. But I think that that's not going to be the case when it's a game that counts. You're going to have someone, a student, a sports department member, maybe it's a retired official that operates that shot clock. So that's a little bit difficult for me to buy, because we've been doing that the last couple of years. Maybe not with the imminence, you know, once the ball crosses midfield, you start that shot clock right away. But with operating the 30 when the referees yell shot clock, and then right now the referees have been doing the 30-second clearing count. Jeez, you might know better than I am, at least the last 6-8 years, if I'm not mistaken.
I think it's so. I think it was put in place for the 2008 right. season. Yeah.
It's all blending together, Terry. It's all blending together. But I don't buy that either.
The idea of squishiness around being able to start the clearing clock in order to avoid the stoppage of play because of the possession clock. What's your if that indeed was one of the motivating factors? Are you okay with that?
Define squishiness.
It's since the clearing clock is not visible, it can start gotcha. 2 seconds after possessions gained, and the sidelines won't go crazy.
Look, that I can't say it happens all the time, but it, I think that does happen frequently just because, let's say the goaltender makes a save, defender picks the ball up, defensive midi picks the ball up. Now we've got a change in possession. Just inherently from seeing it, making sure that we do have a change of possession, and now the clearing clock is in play, referee has to reach down and hit that buzzer. That could take a second or two, to locate the buzzer. Maybe the lever gets stuck. I don't know. Maybe as they're, as the change of possession happens, he's got a defender coming right at him, and he's got to get out of the way and can't hit the button and do, two things at once. There's all kinds of variables that go into that. Same thing with the, now the old shot clock. Once, that trail official signals, boom, shot clock, the operator may have taken a second to hit the button. That happens, that happens, and that's the human element in it, and I don't think it's a huge deal.
The other big rule change on Friday was the return of the crease dive. For my money, it takes what had been a two-option outcome for a referee, a play that had two optional outcomes, either a push or an in-the-crease call, and it adds a third option, which it can be a push, it can be an in-the-crease, or it can be a fairly executed dive. Is that the way that you see it? And if so, is that easier? Is that an improved situation for referees?
I think that the dive is something that, depending upon who you're talking to, could be a hot topic. But I think overall, it just kind of is what it is. I do think that the one thing that the new rule, if I'm reading it correctly, and I've got to read it, I've got to understand it, digest it. Then you talk to other people, coaches, officials, players, to get their take on it. And then, you get in there as a referee and you learn the mechanic and what we're looking for. And here's the, here are the ARs and here's all the variables that go into making that call. I think what this eliminates is the grounded versus not grounded argument. Was a foot touching or a toe touching or a shoelace touching or a cleat touching? Now it's, they can leave their feet on their own. But I think the challenge now becomes, if I'm reading this rule correctly, are they diving toward the goal, which is not a good dive? Are they diving away from the goal, which is a good dive? So I think you still have some subjectivity in this. And there is no instant replay to go back and look at it to determine what happens. So I think that from an official standpoint, adjudicating and administering this is going to be a little bit of a challenge. It's not going to be insurmountable, but you're going to have goals that are allowed that maybe shouldn't be, and you're going to have goals disallowed that maybe shouldn't be. But I do think it might alleviates the grounding call. And who knows, maybe it alleviates as well the pushes. Was it a push? Was it not a push? Just physics. When you get inside a defender and you stop moving and they're continuing to go forward, yeah, they're going to make contact. They're going to, by definition, push you into the crease, earn the flag. And, now we've either have a good goal and the flag's wiped out, or we've got a miss and the team offended goes up for 30 seconds. It's going to be interesting to see how this plays out.
It's interesting. The other kind of substantial change coming away from this was the shrinking of the substitution box from 20 yards, 10 on either side of the midline.
Hey, Terry, real quick, let's just touch on, I should have mentioned this, the player safety of
dives. I was going to bring it up in the
dives.
Context of the substitution box. Yes.
All right, man.
Yes. Come
you,
on.
You, go
you
ahead.
Gotta trust your host. I'm the pilot, man.
I'm used to being with D Fly, he's just, we got that synergy going, but it's all good. Hey, are we going to talk about player safety around the dive is my question.
Yeah, we'll talk about player safety at large. I wanted to talk about it in the context of including the substitution box, because so this was something that I had heard, for the majority of the 2018 season was a request among folks, you know, particularly at ESPN and some of the other folks that, you know, were, I would call stakeholders. That was something that they wanted to see. And it didn't really get a ton of conversation. And coming away from it, I feel like it hasn't gotten a ton of conversation in terms of negative reaction either. But when it was put into place, the idea was around the notion of player safety. And obviously that was also the case for the crease dive. You know, the crease dive had been adjudicated out of the game in the 2000s. It's been more than a decade without. And so the idea of protecting both the player, the offensive player, the attacking player, who is, you know, pretty much leading with his head, but is now, you know, ordered to do so away from the goal, as well as the goalie, who, if the player dives into him, is going to have to absorb all of that contact in a relatively defenseless position. You know, there are two parallel conversations around player safety, but what's fascinating is that until our prep conversation for this, I don't think I had a full understanding of the player safety issue around the substitution box sides. And you know, I think that I still maintain that the incidence of injuries around crease dives is pretty limited. And so there's this, like, the balance of the cost to strategy versus the benefit of increasing safety to players and where that balance falls. So I guess I'm interested in your perspective on both kind of conjoined and then independently as well.
Well, let's talk about the dive first. And I've made this joke. Maybe you'll get the joke. Maybe you won't, because we're a little different in age. But, you know, the dive became a lot like hair bands and grunge bands. You know, it was pretty good when the guys who knew what they were doing and kind of set the bar, it was pretty darn good. But then when you had copycats come in, that kind of killed both genres, as well as a change in taste. But I think the dive just became, everybody thought they could do it, and guys that weren't very gifted at it or good at it started doing it, and it became very reckless in the game. So I think that's why the rules committee and the powers that be stepped in and changed the rule. I think players these days, coaches these days, and with it coming back, it's not going to be the kamikaze type situations that we had back in the late 90s, early 2000s when this thing went out. So, you know, it's going to be interesting to see how it comes. You know, goaltenders, you know, they are vulnerable, absolutely, with a guy coming flying at them out of control. And let's say a kid does that, you know, the goal's taken off the board, but if he takes a goalie's legs out or, you know, makes contact up around the head neck area potentially, or let's say the goalie, you know, gets the jump and lays out the diver, you know. So I still think those player safety issues, although not incredibly abundant, still exist. And I was at a youth tournament, not this summer, but the summer before, where a player, I didn't see the play, so I'm not sure if he dove or if he was pushed, but a young goalie who was, 12, 13 years old, suffered a compound fracture of his leg, you know, when the player went into him. So, you know, even without the dive, those types of dangerous situations exist. But I think with the dive, it can become troublesome if you have kids doing it and players doing it that just don't know what they're doing. And they're just trying to be reckless about it. But, you know, see how that plays out. And then the substitution box, that's just, you know, the players have not become smaller or slower or anything of that nature. And it's not, you know, you're going to have benches closer to each other. So chirping could get escalated in terms of, you know, but I don't know. We'll have to see how that plays out, but more for a referee. So under the former box, now the 20 yards, referees didn't have to go in and police the area. They didn't have to leave the field and take their eyes off the action. The old mechanic now with it'll be interesting to see if it comes back with the shortening of the box again, is the referee's going to have to circle in there, police the area, clear it. You're taking a body off the field, a set of eyes off of the action in a game that's already now going to be a little bit more urgent on the offensive end because of the 60-second shot clock. So I think that's going to hurt officials in a little bit of a way. But when it comes to the player safety, it's now you have players, if you do the cat and mouse game, trying to get guys on, trying to get guys off, trying to gain the advantage on the offensive end of the field, you could have some jostling, and the tighter box area could invite some unwarranted contact or unwanted contact between players getting on and off the field. And, of course, the referees have to be there to police that. Do we have to be there to check that out? The other thing, and this might be kind of way down on the food chain, with referees not having to go to the substitution box and police it, the player, if you already have six offensive players on the field, you know, the kid, or you only, you know, the kid who's going to sub in or go play offense from the midline steps over maybe a second too soon, or the kid coming out of the box steps on, a half step too soon. Refs don't see it. Coaches will yell, oh, they have too many, but there's no advantage gained. So coaches let it go pretty quickly. Now, if a referee's in that area or watching that box, does he have to make those calls? Does he have to stay true to the spirit of the rules and call that? Because there are, quote unquote, too many men, even though an advantage wasn't gained. So I think that might be an unintended consequence. Although, again, in the scheme of things, that might be very, very minute.
Yeah, it's the point that you made in the middle there that resonates with me. I didn't see the shrunk substitution box as a player safety issue because there weren't unintentional collisions happening with any frequency. But I do agree that the players being 10 yards closer, I mean, you know, we're less than 3 months removed from a fracas between the Ohio State and Johns Hopkins benches at the Big Ten tournament, that combined with the lack. So when two players are, you see this all the time, two guys are running the box, they're shoulder to shoulder because, you know, somebody just aggrieved somebody else on the field. And then they separate. When they get off the field, they run in opposite directions. Well, if one guy doesn't want to separate, he has more of an excuse for why he didn't in a 10-yard box than in a 20-yard box because he has less place to go. And so the idea of shouldering somebody up off the field and leading to a heated exchange, that I actually can see happening with greater frequency, particularly when you're talking about this isn't just, you know, 15 games a year among top 20 teams. This is, you know, roughly 20 games a year among 400 teams. You know, these instances of guys running shoulder to shoulder off the field are pretty frequent. And, yeah, that was something that I didn't really consider until about 20 minutes ago.
And I think the other thing is also the visibility that the referees have into the substitution box. With it being such a wide berth, you can see a lot of things. You know, you can, and it's easy to tell a coach to get out of the box from, you know, if you're standing 15 yards away from him. Now, again, it's just tighter quarters. Coaches do like to meander a little bit onto the field, into the substitution box, especially the coach running the box, just trying to keep those areas clean. And you also have to keep in mind, and again, this could be way down on the list of priorities, but you got to keep that area clear for scorekeepers and game personnel. And who knows where the shot clock operator is going to be housed in certain facilities. It could be down on the field if that's the way that their facility is set up or wired. So, you know, just a couple things to consider.
Well, with apologies to all of my SID friends who I'm sure are listening to this podcast with bated breath, when we start talking about you and the table, that probably means it's time to bring the podcast to a close. Mark, we really appreciate your time on the Inside Lacrosse Emergency Podcast. We've got new rules. Any final parting comments?
Yes. The game's evolving, and it's interesting. It really is. I'm actually looking forward to one thing, and maybe we could talk about this in the future. Maybe we don't need to tinker with the rules every 2 years. Maybe we can give it a 4 or 5 year cycle, let things play out, unless there's major problems. But the benefit of it is, you know, we're entering some very new territory. If this stuff doesn't pan out, you know, maybe, you know, it only lasts for 2 years. So, good and bad things to be considered there, but, you know, maybe as the sport gets more mature and continues to evolve, revisit the rules and change the rules with less frequency, potentially.
Inside Lacrosse Podcasts, the source of the sport.